can evoke such strong memories and associations, and there are many ingredients and recipes that really evoke a sense of our great state. But how do we get kids involved with preparing their own meals and sharing those stories and traditions at the same time? Well, our guests today have thought a lot about exactly that and are the co-authors of The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller, and very happy to have Therese Allen here. She's the author of many books and articles about Wisconsin's food traditions and culinary culture, including the original book written for grown-ups, The Flavor of Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us today, Therese.
Thank you for having me.
And as the former director of the Office of School Services for the Wisconsin Historical Society, Bobby Malone has a lot of experience getting kids interested in history. She's also written and edited many books for young readers and co-wrote The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids with Therese. Great to see you again, Bobby.
It's great to see you, Judith.
Well, I really like that you focus on both the land and the people living on it as factors shaping Wisconsin's flavor. How did you decide to do it that way, Bobby?
You know, I'm not. We knew we didn't want to organize it the same way that the grown-up version was organized, because we wanted to appeal to kids. And one of the things that's so interesting about Wisconsin, I know I have the voice of a non-native because I'm originally from Texas,
but we've adapted you happily.
Yes, and I know more about Wisconsin than any place I've ever lived, just because of the work
sure.
I've done, and I've loved it. And that we're such a resource-rich state. And I think the foods that you mentioned at the beginning, the kind of icon foods, mm-hmm. are just really are, if you scratch below, why is it, why are cheese curds, why are cream puffs, you know, why are brats? Because of the people and the kinds of ways our land has worked. So, and kids are very interested in the environment. That's their natural...
Right.
bent, and they really are concerned, third graders, but even young kids, about recycling, about taking care mm-hmm. of things. And they're the perfect age to introduce to gardening.
Right.
And you know, they're little boys that hunt with their dads are beginning to understand that. So all of those traditions are so important to Wisconsin, and we are a more diverse state.
And I think also
no one would think.
And I think pointing out, you know, I think as a kid, whatever you're familiar with, whatever's down the street or whatever you do on the weekends with your family, you assume that that's everywhere. And, you know, for me, actually growing up in Chicago, I lived quite near Oak Park, Illinois, which is Frank Lloyd Wright home and studio and everything, Frank Lloyd Wright homes all over. I didn't think Frank Lloyd Wright was a very big deal until I moved to Madison and thought, oh, he's kind of famous, isn't he? But because it was down the street, you know, you just don't think about it that
well,
much.
Well, I think people think sometimes that culture is something that you learn by going to a museum or to the symphony or,
right.
you know, and that only certain people have culture.
Right.
Or that history is something that you learn by learning dates and in mm-hmm. and chronological
right.
order. And kids don't necessarily think that way.
No,
they think
right.
about what's the world around me. And
right.
the world around them, so much of it, of course, is based on food.
That's, right.
You know, there's so much they can learn about the environment and about their history and about their culture by the stories that the foods tell them. So we arranged the book that way on purpose so that they could think about the source of the foods that they're eating.
And Therese, you've written a lot about food. Is how is it different writing for kids?
Oh.
You know, keeping that those readers in mind.
It's very different. Thank goodness for Bobby Malone.
Well, that's kind of how we divided the task. We really worked hard, and this is true for every book I've collaborated on. The kind of the hardest part is deciding the organization and how that's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an easy division of labor for this because I'm good on the kiddifying.
Yeah, she calls herself the kiddifier.
The kiddifier.
And I'm the foodifier.
So it was, you know, it was a great division of labor mm-hmm. and we could communicate.
Yeah, what I liked was learning the language of children. You know, when you write for adults, you really want to be as descriptive as possible and get a little, you know, poetic if you can. That's part of the beauty of language and of reading. And kids, of course, like some of that, but it has to be simpler. So, and it, for me, it was very fun to let sort of the inner kid in me go and be kind of goofy and corny and more exclamation points. And
yeah, that's true, isn't it?
Well, you want to be exciting. It was great that we were able to do the book in color.
Yes.
And have lots and lots of photographs and drawings. And So it's very it's a very attractive book to kids.
And I want to make clear, I mean, this is a book geared towards kids, but these are real recipes with real
history.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I one of the ways that you can tell it's for kids is that you, besides the recipes and the history, you also include basic directions for not only how to be successful, but safe in the kitchen. And, you know, a lot of kids, because maybe their parents didn't learn them, it's hard. They don't know how to use a knife correctly, or even a vegetable peeler or something that seems, you know, pretty innocuous. But you give, you know, not heavy handed, but you give little hints about how to use the different tools. I was telling Bobby before the show that I had a book as a kid called The Cook-Along Book. And this book was published in the 60s or maybe very early 70s, and it was geared towards kids. And I still use this cookbook. I mean, it's pretty disgusting at this point with lots of stains and rips and everything. But there's some really good basic recipes in there. But in the middle of a recipe, all of a sudden in all caps, it'll say, be careful with that knife, or have you washed your hands recently? And it cracks me up every time. But, you know, it really did help me as a kid learn, you know, the those things that you need to be thinking about, whatever you're cooking.
Sure. I think the more stains, the better.
In
fact, when I couldn't
cookbook.
Remember what I was looking for a recipe recently, and I thought, which recipe was it? And I just opened my favorite cookbooks to the page that the same recipe in a bunch of them and found, ah, it must have been this one because there's much more stuff written on it.
It's obviously well used. So what ages are you aiming for with the book?
Well, it starts with fourth grade. Yeah.
So about 9 years old.
Yes. And of course, this is an intergenerational book, and it's meant for families to work together, for kids to work with an adult. But like you said, there's enough instruction so that as they age, they could also use the book on their
sure.
own.
And I think a teacher, even of younger kids, could tell the stories mm-hmm. behind the, or read them
sure.
aloud to a child. And then there's some recipes that are designed with that we had a different number of spoons. So recipes kids can do alone, recipes with an adult, and there's some non-cooking recipes.
Right, yeah, you designate if it needs heat or not.
it's mainly a family book,
sure.
but you could use it in a classroom.
Or a summer camp. Or
a camp, yeah, or mm-hmm. a Girl Scout troop, or whatever.
Yeah. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today and talking with Therese Allen and Bobby Malone. They are the co-authors of The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids. We'd love to have you join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Our on-air producer, Cynthia Schuster, will be happy to answer your call. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And be sure to visit our Facebook page. Not only do we have information about the book, but we also put some of the wonderful recipes up there. And from The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids, we have recipes for butter-glazed carrot coins with fresh mint, which I was telling Therese and Bobby I'm planning on making myself tonight, smoked fish cream cheese spread, and schmorn. And we'll talk a little bit more, especially about schmorn, because I think that's probably not a familiar word. But join in. We'd love to hear from you. So you talk about foods that come from forests, waters and wetlands, fields and orchards, meat and dairy farms, and backyards and gardens. So like you said, you were really focusing on how kids look at foods. Where are they coming from? Where do they see them? Let's talk about forests first, because I don't think that's one of the first areas where people think of finding food. What are some of the foods that come from forests, and how do we generally harvest them? Therese?
Well, there's nuts, there's mushrooms. Of course, there's wild animals from the forest, small and large. Also, the greens that come from the forest. We're just coming out of that time of year where the greens in particular, ramps, nettles, sorrel, mm-hmm. dandelion greens, wild onions, those kinds of things. And it's a great way for kids to connect with the environment and to bring it back into the kitchen and make it their own. It's also a great way to teach them about, you know, the variety of foods that come from the forest. Many of the families in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, are deer hunters. And that's another, you know, wonderful way for the generations to work together and talk about their traditions. So it's, forests are full of great foods.
And it's also a way, besides helping them find delicious things, it's just a way to help them develop their powers of observation,
Yes,
you know, showing them what something looks like, what you're looking for, where, you know, if you say morels are usually growing in this kind of environment, they're then learning about what that kind of environment looks like, too.
Well, kids make the very best morel hunters, in my estimation, because they're closer to the ground and they can see them better.
They have those young eyes, too. Those are always
they
helpful.
Do.
I don't know that kids naturally think about where the food comes from. But once you point it out, then they are really aware of it. Then that makes their kind of interest in environment and their interest in food, it links them together. So that was one of the purposes behind our organization of the book.
And indeed, so many kids today, too many kids today are really in a disconnect from food because a lot of the foods that they're eating would be fast foods or packaged foods or microwave foods, and they don't have a sense that this... you know, food comes from the grocery store.
Right. So, via the freezer.
Yeah, right.
So just thinking about where does it come from and why is that food a big thing in Wisconsin? Because I think that, you know, as I said, that we're so resource rich, more than a lot of states, that and we have very different kinds of environments. So that's one of the things that kids can, it's those connections that we want kids to make.
And I think one of the great things about kids, too, is when you point something out like that to them, it's almost impossible to get them to turn it off, too. So, you know, once you say, we're looking for whatever, I mean, they're going to be looking for it weeks later when you're not even thinking of it. All of a sudden they'll say, look, there's a, you know, there's whatever. So, I think that's great. One of the things that you talk about coming from forest is maple syrup and the whole tradition of maple sugaring. And how did that start in Wisconsin?
Well, it's an old Indian tradition, and we really worked hard to include that a lot of these traditions really began with the people first living here. They may have collected it, they certainly collected it in very different ways. I mean, we don't use birch bark macaques anymore,
right.
But the fact that that was their sweet treat. I remember an archaeologist friend at the Historical Society was talking to a group of young kids, and she was talking about all the things the Indians did with hunting and gathering before they became agricultural people thousands of years ago. And one of the kids was really worried and said, raised her hand and said, well, did they have chocolate chip cookies? You know? So it would have been my concern, too. But she said they didn't have chocolate chip cookies, but they had cranberries that they dried, and they had maple syrup and maple sugar, and they had treats.
Right. And that's also great because it's showing that even across different time periods and different cultures, there are some universal things like everybody likes a little sweet something once in a while.
Sure. And I love that sense of magic, I think, that kids get when they realize, you know, not just the taste of something and the wonder of something, like you get this this water coming out of a out of tree bark, and it turns into this magical, delicious, sweet thing. But then for them to be able to make the connection, that historical connection, that this goes back thousands of years, and that children who were here thousands of years ago also tasted the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You then move into waters and wetlands, and what are some of the traditions that you touch on there and some of the ingredients we get from there? I mean, I think we think of things like fish and then fish boils, which especially Door County is known for, but there are also things like wild rice.
Right, which was one of the main foods for Native peoples. And then the Ojibwe tradition that they were following a conch shell to get to Wisconsin, where there would be food that grew on water.
Oh, interesting.
And wild rice has a sacred relationship to the Ojibwe people especially. But it was, I mean...
It sounds almost like the biblical manna in the desert.
We think of it as being, you know, around Lake Superior. But wild rice grew in Madison,
really?
Around Lake Mendota and around Lake Monona. The native people that were living here when the first white settlement came. We're harvesting
the Menominee tribe. Menomen is the name for wild rice, and so the name of the tribe comes from
all the native people in Wisconsin ate wild rice and still do.
Cranberries is another one.
Right.
It's another ancient tradition, and we tend, I think, to think that cranberries weren't here first, that they came from the East Coast.
Right.
But that's not true. Cranberries were here. In fact, the name for cranberries comes from the way that the cranberry bush or stalk looks like a crane. Oh. And the cranes, of course, are in the marshlands and the wetlands mm-hmm. around where cranberries would have grown. By the children, you know, reading about and finding cranberries and eating cranberries and cooking with cranberries, they're also learning about the history that goes that far back, but also goes to the 1860s when Edward Sackett, is that his name? Edward Sackett, came from the East Coast and saw that we had vines here and said, wow, we could make a commercial industry out of this. And that's another whole story.
And so we really have the largest industry in the country. I think people think of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
But it's really...
I knew we had been at some point, and it sounds like we still are.
We're still number one.
We're still number one.
We are.
Well, we're talking about the flavor of Wisconsin for kids with authors Therese Allen and Bobby Malone. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or emailing us at talk@wpr.org. What foods or recipes really typify Wisconsin for you? What are the flavors that are strong ties to your family's history and culture or that of your larger community? We'd love to hear from you and have you join in the conversation. Talking about the flavor of Wisconsin for kids and how we can get kids interested not just in cooking food and enjoying great meals, but also the history of those foods in Wisconsin and how they tie into the larger cultures. We're talking with Therese Allen and Bobby Malone, who wrote the book, The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids. And I want to note that it's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, which puts out a lot of great books about Wisconsin and whose authors we always enjoy having on. So this is no exception. So we were talking about waters and wetlands and some of the foods that come from there. You know, there are also waterfowl and freshwater animals and, of course, fish. And as you were saying earlier, Bobby, I mean, fishing, hunting, trapping is really a huge part of Wisconsin's culture. And again, something that the native people were doing and then the white settlers also took on.
Right. And, you know, those are, you know, we always joke about the people from Illinois coming up or any place else to enjoy Wisconsin recreation, which is a huge part mm-hmm. of our economy. And it really did start off with, you know, people finding out when the Europeans came here that we had an abundance of wonderful water-based resources.
In the book, we talk about the differences between subsistence fishing and commercial fishing and also sport fishing. And if you look at those three, you can see the history. We tie in, of course, what happens when commercial fishing goes too far. And so kids get an environmental lesson, and they're just much more aware of, you know, what when they're fishing and they're eating fish, what that means in terms of the environment.
Mm-hmm. And one of the recipes that we put up on the Facebook page, it's a note with recipes from this segment and also the Eat More Vegetables segment that's coming up at 11:45. We have a recipe for smoked fish cream cheese spread, which sounds really delicious. And I really like in the introduction to that recipe, you talk about the fact that smoking was not just for the flavor and not mm-hmm. just because it made things delicious, but because
it preserved
things. There were not refrigerators, there were not freezers. People were hunting, fishing, trapping, growing things. And, you know, we're in the upper Midwest. We have a long winter that, you know, we often, especially in times where people were living on a more subsistence level, people had to make what grew in those 5 months or that they could hunt or fish last through that long, cold winter. And so smoking was a really good way to do that.
And I think we're in the North Woods areas where there are a lot of people that still live in a very subsistence way. They still depend on a lot of native people and others depend on what they hunt mm-hmm. and fish and gather and preserve for the rest of the year because the economic options aren't as large as they are in urban areas.
There's another lesson to be learned there, too, and I love these cultural combination stories, and the smoked fish cream cheese spread is a good example of that because, of course, the Indians would not have had cream cheese. They would not have had milk because they didn't have cows. And so it's a good story to tell about the coming together of cultures, the fish, the smoking, and the dairy products. There's lots of stories like that in the book. Maple butter is another good mm-hmm. example of that one, where the maple and dairy comes together.
Right.
Creates a new flavor.
And, of course, people that came, that settled in Wisconsin were from, I mean, at least originally were Northern Europeans. Mm-hmm. And they brought their own traditions of smoked fish.
Sure.
So it was really kind of a, a great merger that way,
right.
too.
And I'm sure some of the fish types were probably the same, but they were probably also encountering different types of fish that they didn't have back in the old country. But they, you know, they tried out the ways that they kept their fish back home, and sure enough, it worked with these too. So yeah, it's both holding on to the past and then adapting it to the present, I think.
Actually, there was a deeper meaning to that recipe, and that's that I had to get it in there because it's one of my favorite things to eat. Yes,
so there's the deeper meaning right
there.
Right.
That's one of the benefits of being able to choose. Well, I have to say that the three recipes from this book and the three from Eat More Vegetables that I put up on the Facebook page are all things that I'm planning on making. So so I did the same thing. So far we've talked mostly about foods that we gather or hunt, but you also talk about agriculture, and there's certainly a lot of Wisconsin history tied to agricultural innovations. Some people are really surprised about things that started here or were invented here. What are some of the highlights that you two wanted to point out to kids?
In terms of agricultural innovations, I think that in general in North America, people coming from Europe came from places where there were a lot of people and very little land. There was a lot of labor to work that land. And coming to the New World, mm-hmm. New World to Europeans, there was a lot of land and a few people. So they needed to be innovative. And I remember years ago learning that more patents had been taken on agricultural implements. So someplace in the Midwest, it may have been Missouri, mm-hmm. but there certainly is a lot of innovation everywhere in American farming because of the kind of relative mm-hmm. people to land. There
right.
was so much land, and there were just a few family members maybe to work it. So
right.
how could we do it most efficiently?
Right. Something that springs to mind for me is Stephen Babcock. He changed the dairy industry. In fact, he really helped further and create the dairy industry with his butterfat test, right, and that was here, of course, in Wisconsin, with the university and with the diversity of agriculture. We've had, you know, many agricultural innovations, but mm-hmm. that's one that really sort of changed the face of the industry,
right?
And that's part of that Wisconsin idea too,
exactly.
about
mm-hmm.
the university and the agricultural extension, training people here, going out to farmers, helping them. This was all to control the quality mm-hmm. of butter and milk,
right?
To make sure that those products were what they said they were.
Right.
That sense that, or the belief or commitment to sharing knowledge, that mm-hmm. knowledge would be shared and not kept as some kind of academic, you know, precious thing, but that it would be used for the greater purpose. It's the kind of a sense we want to get across to kids in this book also.
Well, a lot of pride in that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is a pretty unique relationship between the University of Wisconsin system, not just Madison, and the rest of the state, that there is this back and forth. So, you know, things were being conceived of in labs and classrooms and, you know, academic offices here, but then is this going to work? And mm-hmm. so going out to the farmers and mm-hmm. saying, you know, would you try this and let us know how this works? And then the farmers reporting back, and then the farmers getting the advantage of this new knowledge or technique. And with the butter fat test, part of that too was that the farmers were then getting paid what they should be paid for their high quality dairy too. So, you know, it really is a very synergistic relationship, mm-hmm. I think, between the two.
And even our transportation system is, you know, which is not a part of eating, but if you think about how fast you have to get that milk to market meant
right.
that we have wonderful roads,
mm-hmm.
also part of that progressive, you know, just
right.
another facet of our progressive tradition.
Right. So you also cover gardening. Tell us about the gardens that Native Americans planted. I especially like the concept of the Three Sisters.
Mm-hmm. The Three Sisters would be corn, squash, and beans. The Three Sisters were always together in the garden because they helped each other grow. The beans were lower, the corn would grow high, and help support the vines from the squash. And so, of course, those three, especially in southern Wisconsin, were really, really important crops. corn in particular, corn was absolutely central. The ways that Indians prepared corn was just myriad. I love the way they would roast what was kind of a popcorn, mm-hmm. a type of popcorn, roast it, and then ground it up. And they would make pemmican out of it, kind of right. the original sausage, if you will. They would combine wild rice, game, maple syrup, and ground corn.
It had that sweet,
sweet edge, too.
Yeah. Well, again, and maple. Maple, of course, was much more than a sweetener. It was an herb, really, if you will, an herbal or a spice type of flavor that they would add. They would eat it in savory dishes as well as sweet.
And then you also, I really like this as well, then, for instance, you talk about how important corn was to the Native mm-hmm. Americans, but then you also include corn recipes from Mexican immigrants mm-hmm. who are, you know, much later. So you have hull corn soup. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about that?
Hull corn soup? Do you want to talk about that?
You know, I liked it.
You're going to tell us about pozole. I know that.
Yeah, pozole. Well, I think that, you know, corn, again, was an essential crop all over the Americas. You know, you think of Mesoamerica mm-hmm. and corn gods and corn goddesses and all the stories related to that. So that people had those traditions. And, you know, there's the corn and the soup and the fact that it was hulled corn, mm-hmm. like hominy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is very similar
They're
to pozole.
They're very similar, right. And they talk about that in the recipe, about how if you start with it would have been some kind of wild game or venison, obviously,
the meat.
Early on. But in the Mexican/Texas tradition, it would be pork. Anyway, so if you go to a Native American powwow anywhere in the state now, you may see stands for hulled corn soup, and that's that large kernel hulled corn mm-hmm. With the meat, chicken or pork, and very simple spices. If you're going to have it in the Mexican mm-hmm. At Cinco de Mayo or in a Mexican right. home, then it's going to have hot spices in it.
And
it's
cilantro.
And cilantro right. and the wonderful crunchy toppings. And,
yeah.
But they're essentially the same, come from the same source. It's okay. just regional differences.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Miller today and talking with Therese Allen and Bobby Malone. They are the co-authors of The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids. What have you taught your children about cooking and cooking traditions? What did you learn as a child that really ties you to a place and a time and a certain culture of eating? We'd love to hear from you when you call 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And I hope you'll stay tuned at 11:45, where we'll continue our food conversation with Tricia Cornell. She will join us to discuss her book, Eat More Vegetables, Making the Most of Your Seasonal Produce. So we talked a little bit about early and later waves of immigrants. You know, you discuss gardens that those immigrants planted to be able to enjoy the foods that they were accustomed to and missed. What are some of those ingredients that obviously were, you know, ties to the old country, and how are they using them?
Well, herbs and spices in particular, I think. Certain vegetables, too, of course. Poles and Northern Europeans would have really gone for the root vegetables.
Even longer colder winters there.
Yes, if that's possible. But I think herbs is a really good example. In fact, I think we do a dish in the book with tomatoes and different fresh herbs that can have a different ethnic flavor to it, if you will. Early on, of course, Germans would have had to have had chives in the garden, if you will, because you can't have a wonderful German omelet for breakfast without chives in it. The Scandinavians, of course, would have been going for dill. You would have seen mm-hmm. dill. And Poles, actually, a lot of the Northern Europeans would have gone for dill. Italians would have fennel and mm-hmm. oregano, et cetera. So you can see, in fact, there's a wonderful book by another Wisconsin Historical Society author, Marcia Carmichael. It's called Putting Down Roots.
Yes,
was she on the program?
On with Larry, yes.
And she, the whole book really is about how you can read a culture by reading its immigrant gardens. And she's the gardener at
the historical,
the historical gardener at Old World Wisconsin, and there's a whole book about those variations.
Yeah, and that's
it's fun to
roots.
See that in community gardens in Madison.
I love that.
Where just the way people have planted in the community garden. If you're a gardener, you can say, "Oh, that's a Hmong gardener."
Right, mm-hmm. right.
that's definitely Mexican Americans right. that have planted that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's fun to see the way they've, you know, mm-hmm. all the way they fence or stalks or whatever traditions that they brought with them mm-hmm. are still. You know, we're still an immigrant state.
Right. And I think, you know, again, going back to those universals, one of the universals is everybody likes a little sweet treat once in a while. Another universal is everybody has an idea of what comfort food is. And I think, you know, especially when you're in a new place and, you know, trying to figure out and adapt to a different culture and maybe a different language and, you know, different ways of living. Those comfort foods, those familiar foods that really harken back to another time, another place, connections to family, mm-hmm. ancestors, can take on even more importance, I think.
And when kids think about, you know, that we were talking earlier about that kids aren't always aware that what they're experiencing is culture, mm-hmm. then when you introduce them to that idea, and then they'll think, oh, yeah, my grandma makes. Mm-hmm. And how important those stories are. And if you talk to people when they've grown up and they're remembering their childhood or their grandparents, especially their grandmothers, it's always the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. I have a dish in my family. I'm from the Green Bay area originally, and part of my culture is Belgian. And we have a Christmas cookie that we make called a Buno, which actually comes from a term, bon année, which means good year mm-hmm. in Belgium. But we would always make it. We had a special iron that actually came over with my great-grandparents. And we'd make these small cookies one at a time. And there was so much I learned, so many lessons I learned about the connections of the generations, about responsibility. We had sort of a rite of passage. You would first be able to roll the little dough into little balls, work your way up, eventually could be at the iron, that sort of thing. But I remember thinking and being so impressed with how my father, you know, made them this way when he was young. His mother made them that way when she was young. And that connection again to the generations and the sense of responsibility and, mm-hmm. you know, family connections that came out of that.
Right? And family pride. Mm-hmm. You know, that kids can feel, oh, yeah, well, we've got that.
Right.
And my, and I don't think there are a lot of things in our current very fast-paced totally connected, but not necessarily.
Yeah.
There's a lot of depth there. There's a way to get that kind of instantly by mm-hmm. by talking about
intuitively.
Well, and also kind of built into what you were saying, Therese, is that if you're there, you know, taking on your job of rolling the dough or pressing the dough or whatever, you're there with other family members. Mm-hmm. And so you're hearing, you know, it's not like a let's sit down and talk about our family history. It's
right.
Here we are making these cookies that we look forward to every year. And, oh, did you know that Aunt Sarah used mm-hmm. to, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's right. just, it just creates an atmosphere of sharing and learning without it feeling like it's, you
In
know,
fact, that's incredible. The kind of, you know, subtext of the entire book, that it's a book to experience intergenerally, mm-hmm. intergenerationally.
Well, and I have to say, you know, talking about the things that you grow up with and you just assume that this is food that everyone's eating, I remember very distinctly going to school and talking about anchovy soup because I thought everybody ate anchovy soup and being met with these completely blank stares from my mother was from an Italian family. My father was from a Polish family and the anchovy soup was from the Italian side and just people looking at me like,
What is that?
Yeah, and not looking like they were, you know, dying to have a taste either. I loved my mother's anchovy soup, but, you know, it's the same kind of thing. It's just anchovy soup. Of course we have anchovy soup. So I wish I knew how to make that anchovy soup. That's one of my projects someday is I'm going to trial and error. Try to work
right after the carrots with mint.
Right after the carrots with mint. That'll be tonight. I'll knock those out, no problem.
And that's an easy dish.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
As you said earlier, that some of these dishes that are simple would appeal to more than a child because they're delicious
right.
and that they're easy to prepare
right.
is a bonus.
Right. But I like, too, that, you know, the recipes in the book, you wrote them in a way that is understandable for kids, but they're not dumbed down recipes either. You know, they're not, you know, and it's not taking necessarily some things are prepared like the cream cheese you were mentioning. But, you know, it's not assuming that kids can't take a whole mm-hmm. carrot and figure out how to turn them into carrot coins and, you know, things like that. I mean, they're real recipes. So one of the ones that we put up on the Facebook page is called Schmorn. And I just thought that sounded wonderful. And you describe it as being kind of a cross between pancakes
and scrambled eggs,
which I thought was really interesting. And this is a Slovenian dish. Why don't you tell us a little bit about šmorn?
Well, you make a batter, of an eggy pancake-type batter with flour and eggs, etc., a little baking powder, and you mix it up, and you put it in a cast iron pan or a pan, and you start by making one large pancake, basically. Let it brown on the bottom, put the cover on, and let it finish cooking so that it becomes a thick pancake, and then you go at it with a
and that's the part that surprised me. Right. Yeah,
what fun for kids. Yeah. This is one of the reasons I thought it was such a great recipe.
I was typing along and I thought, whoa,
now you start cutting it up and smashing it up. And pretty soon you have really a mixture that's more like scrambled eggs than a pancake. And it's fun. It's just fun to, you know, you talk about getting to play with your food.
Yeah. And you said you can serve it with jam or with maple syrup. But you also talk about, and I really like this aspect of it, you really help kids picture the setting. So you talk about, you know, almost every pioneer family would have chickens in the yard. Whether they wanted them or not, they probably had dandelions in the yard. And so they would go out, gather the eggs, and, you know, and also gather the dandelion greens. Can you use dandelion greens after they've flowered, or do you have to catch them before?
You wouldn't want to. They're very bitter.
They're bitter, okay. Yeah. And so they would gather the young dandelions and make a salad. And so it's also pointing out that we think of things like pancakes or scrambled eggs as breakfast, but this could easily be a dinner, and along with a savory salad, it's great.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, we have Tim in Milwaukee on the line who'd like to join in, so let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Hi. This is a traditional recipe in my family, and we just called it cranberry steamed pudding. And in it, for the pudding, it's just flour and hot water with baking soda, cranberries and salt, but they use sorghum. And I was wondering if sorghum was a traditional Wisconsin ingredient.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, not so much anymore. But I think there still are a couple of places in the state where sorghum is being grown and made into sorghum syrup. Looks like dark corn syrup or a dark maple syrup. It has a sweet, very earthy flavor.
It's a stronger flavor.
You can use less, more like molasses.
I was just
really
going to
like
ask.
A dark molasses in flavor. But yes, yeah, I got to visit a sorghum farm years ago. It was in the Fox Valley, and I forget exactly where. And it's a beautiful plant. It's tall, it's majestic, very colorful, just gorgeous.
I think they're actually ornamental sorghum plants.
You can make brooms and things with it too. But I remember watching them process it into syrup. And of course, as you break up the stalks, it's this green gunk that comes out of it. That same sort of magic of how is this going to turn into something delicious.
Like sugar cane.
Also used to make buckwheat pancakes, and she would make a sour buckwheat pancake and then sorghum on that too.
Wow. Well, the cranberry steamed pudding sounds really, really good, and definitely a Wisconsin dish with those cranberries in it.
So, Tim, have you tried it?
We make it every year.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, make sure you pass it down to the kids in your family, too.
We sure will.
Great.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for that call, Tim. And we have been talking with Teresa Allen and Bobby Malone. They are the co-authors of The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids. And I can't believe how quickly the time went by. It was a really great conversation. So, Teresa, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Bobby, always a pleasure.
It was lots of fun.
And you can go to the Facebook page. There's a link there to the Wisconsin Historical Society Press site. They are the publishers of The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids. And you can also check out some of those recipes. Well, if the last 45 minutes has had your mouth watering with all our talk about Wisconsin's wonderful foods, you might want to grab your lunch or at least a snack now, because we're going to keep talking about food. We're going to go next to Tricia Cornell. She wrote Eat More Vegetables, Making the Most of Your Seasonal Produce. And she also has great recipes and techniques to share. So stay tuned here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.